Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. Today is a special day. I'm here with Jade Miller, and Jade and I actually go back and we'll have to figure this out. I think we were at CNL together. I left in the beginning of 2026, and you were probably there. When did you start at CNL?
So we overlapped in, it would have been 2014 through 16, I think.
So we know each other, although the funny thing is, as I was preparing for this, I'm like, clearly I know you, but I don't really know you, which is what makes this so fun for me personally. But I want you to know, listeners, and as well as I never told you this, look, I think having you on this podcast is great. I think just you look at your career, predominantly, if not all, has been the financial services, and then hyper-focused on this private markets or alternatives. And you're somebody who's had a skyrocketed career on paper.
It's been a whirlwind.
You know, and I knew you were an internal, if I remember right, back at CNL, and to see where you have gone so quickly is really impressive. And so I think having people hear your story will be great. Also, I think from a female perspective, as we all know, there's not as many females in the financial services industry. So I'm anxious to kind of get some of your thoughts of that as well. So today you are CEO of Adisa. We'll talk about that. Prior to that, you were at Bourne Financial, who Bob Bourne was one of my bosses at one point. Then we were also at CNL, and you've got other little background. So thank you for joining us, and look forward to diving in and having people understand a little bit more about who Jade is.
No, thanks for having me. I'm excited to jump into it. And as you say that, it's funny, it's easy to remember or forget, I should say, how small this world can be in such a big world, but it is really interconnected and people pop up everywhere, right?
No, it's a great reminder. My kids have all graduated from college, one's still in nursing school. And it is a lesson, not that I always do it well, but be careful about ticking people off, because generally you'll come back around.
Right. You never know who's going to be on what side of the desk.
I hope I never tick you off at CNL. If so, I'm really sorry. So let's start with this, and I'll jump in and ask you some other questions, but let's start with who you are. So give us a little background of where you grew up, kind of where you went to school, and then fill in the dots a little bit on your career so everybody understands how you come to this discussion.
Yeah, so I grew up outside of Atlanta. If you're going to use a real estate term, in a tertiary market. So,
ooh,
you know, I say Atlanta to like make it sound classier. It's about 45 minutes north. I come from a family of four. So I have three other siblings, and we have a big age gap. And then I was very fortunate enough, especially like I came up in the super early 90s, where it wasn't common to have dual working parents, or it was not as common as it is today. And so I was extremely fortunate that my mother was extremely successful professional. So I had that influence my entire life. And then my older sister is 17 years older than me. She's, you know, despite that, she's one of my best friends. She's also been extremely successful in her career. So I was very fortunate from an early age to see the power of independence and hard work in women who also had children, you know, who were able to balance children and career. So I had those role models my entire life. And I'm very grateful for all they've done. They continue to coach and guide and just be a mentor and like what that looks like. And I think that's an important part of my journey, because I have so many friends who would come over to my house or who still call my mom or call my parents, who are like, you were so lucky to have a family that had such a professional viewpoint. So you were able to get that experience, get that knowledge growing up. And I was. It's important to note, my dad was a serial entrepreneur. And I think that's a challenge. He's very type A. I would say, unfortunately, I'm more like my dad than my mother. He always growing up was always working, you know, so work ethic was very important. I was not allowed to go to school unless my car was clean, my car and my room. So every morning, I'm not kidding, the power washer went off on the window at 6 a.m. and I came down and washed the car every morning. But so he had us start working from an early age.
Why did he do that?
One, he's a psycho. No, I say that lovingly. He was very, and I see it now, like he was very OCD. Like, you need to learn the importance of hard work. You need to learn how to appreciate what you have and that like things don't just happen. So in his entrepreneurship, it's interesting. My mom took a very corporate path, tech, Fortune 500 companies. She was traveling, all of these things. And my dad, again, took the entrepreneurial, where he did some different type of like real estate startups. And then he also started to do some of his own things. And I think like part of that was there was a lot of wins and there was a lot of losses, right? Like I learned taking risk early on. So like there were times where I was like, man, we're going to be all right. And then there were times where we lost everything. Like he went ups and downs. And so I think that shapes a lot of like what you learn in the investment space. But one of his endeavors, I don't know if you've seen the show Ozarks.
I have not watched it. I know what it is.
So he invested in a friend who ended up not being a friend, but who wanted a bar. So he bought this bar, and it is in the show Ozarks. It's the Blue Cat Lodge for anyone who's seen it. But we owned that pretty much from my middle school until I was in college. And so I started working there at 13. And my dad, again, had this very much, you are the boss's daughter, but you will work harder than everyone. So like I was never standing around talking, making friends. Like if there was a moment of peace, he was like, go clean the toilets again. I got fired probably 52 times. If anything from, again, my room not being clean to he just didn't like my attitude that day. Like, so the standard was always set really high. Like, if you were going to show up and get this opportunity, you are going to outwork everyone. And I think personally, I played sports growing up and I was one of those, I played soccer. I was one of those athletes where I had a little bit of talent, but not a lot. And so I learned like, okay, hard work can make up for talent. And so that's kind of always been my motto is I'm not always going to be the smartest, or I'm not going to be the fastest, but I'm going to work really hard to make up for that, whatever that is. And I think a lot of that came from growing up in the household that I had and where I was pushed like that. I will say, like, one thing I'm really big on, and I think I took for granted as I was growing up, is my parents, when they were home and when they weren't working, we would all sit down for dinner and just talk. Like, my dad is very good at making you want to ask questions. And I didn't realize what he was doing at the time, but he was building skills for sales, for understanding, for explaining things. It used to drive us insane. He would say, well, what is that? What is that? And it would be something like a new technology on a cell phone. And we're like, Dad, how are you so lame? How do you not know this? He knew it. He was just teaching us how to explain things. And it's like those soft skills that you learn growing up that you're like, man, that was clever on his part. And so I got really fortunate with my family being super supportive and hardworking. And I'm surrounded by siblings who are all successful. I would say we compete to say who's the favorite and who can be more successful. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I had a lot of really excellent role models growing up that propelled me to continue to work hard.
So then, where'd you go to school?
So after I left, I went to Alabama, which is like frowned upon considering I grew up outside of Atlanta. My whole family was, I grew up a Georgia fan. I didn't want to go to Georgia because my whole high school was. So I wanted to stay in the SEC. I went to Alabama, and I would say Roll Tide first, but Alabama was huge in the sense that there was so much going on and there was so much life to be learned. And I did major in finance and economics. Again, I wouldn't say I'm the most book smart. I have siblings, I have friends who I would say, yeah, great test taker. I have colleagues like, John Grady, brilliant.
He's a smart dude.
Right. Yeah. So that was never my strong suit. I think I learned a lot about personality. So I started as a cart girl actually at the local golf course. And that would have been my junior year. And while I was a cart girl, they asked me to work a financial advisor seminar. So, we've been to it. It was a Mayor Price seminar. They fill the room. They're talking about retirement income. I'm passing out waters in the back. And the advisor after was like, well, hey, if you know anyone who needs an internship. And I'm like, hello, I'm pouring waters. So I was very fortunate that the advisor was like, well, great, you want to come be my intern? The flip side was it didn't pay. So then I had to start bartending. So I was an advisory assistant and then I bartended while going to school. And I think the combination of that was so interesting. I've been very fortunate with the people who have come into my life. I think that's a common theme is like I find good people who want to help you succeed. And that is something I can't echo enough for people who are starting in their career. Like finding people who want to be in your corner, who feel like they have a role in your future, can propel you in ways that experience can't. So this financial advisor, he didn't have any kids. Him and his wife, she was a teacher. He'd always wanted a daughter. He didn't have an assistant. He was like, I want to help you. Like, I want to shape your career. So I got extremely lucky that he was like, I'm just going to teach you everything I know. Anything you want to learn, and maybe that was some guilt since he wasn't paying me, but and he was like, anything you want to
But
learn.
it may have been more valuable based on what you're telling us.
It was. He was like, anything you want to learn, any meeting you want to be in. And so that mixed with bartending, you learn how to deal with people. You learn so much. You got to read the room. You got to be smarter. You're dealing with people who sober, drunk, all over the spectrum. So I learned a lot about emotions. And then one day I go in and I'm like, hey, these are really boring, these meetings I'm sitting in. Nothing is clicking here. I'm 21 years old. I sat through RiverSource, no offense, Ameriprise, sat through 10 RiverSource meetings. And I was like, this is so boring. I cannot have this as a career. And he was like, what about this? The guy that's coming in today, it's different than RiverSource. Just sit through it. And it happened to be W.P. Carey. And so it was, I want to say W.P. Carey 16, and they were selling shopping centers. And so as a 21-year-old girl, okay, I can understand why you'd want to invest in J. Crew, right? Like that made sense to me. And so that's where he was like, got it. You understand real estate. Really, it was shopping, but he was like, you understand real estate. And he was like, I'm going to connect you with CNL. So I connected with CNL, who was doing commercial real estate, still wasn't really sure I totally understood what they were doing, but they were like, okay, if you can come take your tests, we'll move you, like move down to Orlando and let's go. And so I jumped on that opportunity. I somehow again passed tests and started with CNL at the time when they were more commercial real estate focused. I would say CNL primarily was when I first joined. And at the time, they had real estate funds as well as a credit fund. And it was a very traditional model back then. I would never, like, I think you've mentioned private markets versus public. The private market space is very niche and it's never going to be like the Wall Street model where you're, you know, like Blackstone, where you're staying at the office until 12. But there was something about being in like the bullpen and you just dialed all day and you get hung up on and you learn what you're saying and you're next to your peers and you're making, you know, bets on who can get someone to pick up. And it was just a really fun environment. And the one thing I will say I took for granted at CNL that I was fortunate enough to have come back into my career was the people and the culture. I think that's something that gets lost a lot in when people look at finance and when they look at investments and all of that. There is a hard work culture. And one of my previous bosses always said, you know, work hard, play hard. But CNL cared about its people. And even if it was annoying, even if it was okay, we all have to walk across to go sit in a 2-hour town hall, they really cared about their people. And when I left CNL for a private equity opportunity, that was something I missed. Like I was just trying to get ahead in my career. And I'm grateful I took the opportunity because it got me to where I am today. But it was like one of those learning points where I was like, that is something that you should always value is the culture of a company. And because how they treat their employees says a lot about who you're dealing with when they're dealing with investments. I don't think the two should be bifurcated. I think that comes down to the core of who someone is as a person. And that is really important when you're trusting that person with your money.
Well, as you know, spending 20 years at CNL, I understand what you're talking about, and I too take that same thing from CNL. Now, there's one thing you said that I think we may have to come back to, but I'm going to say it out loud so I don't forget. It was interesting to me that it was this connection to, in this example, I think you said J.Crew real estate or whatever it was. And I want to come back to that connection point at some point because, as you know, I'm in the impact space today. And I think one of the major drivers of this idea is we've gotten so disconnected from our investment capital. And I actually think you just illustrated that you got connected because of some passion and you can't even fake it. It just happened. And I think the same thing is true on the investing side. We'll come back to that. But do this. You're at Adisa today. Who is Adisa? What's the function of Adisa? And then what is your role at Adisa? And then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So again, after I kind of went through different phases of my career, first after CNL, most importantly, I was at Born Financial, where I was the president of Born and led the distribution as well as operations on the investment. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to be nominated for the Adisa board, which you and I served on together. So I joined the Adisa board back 5 years ago. And for those of you who don't know what Adisa is, it's not Adidas, it's the Alternative Direct Investment Securities Association. So think about an ecosystem for anything that has to do with alternative investments. Adisa's foundation is education, networking, and advocacy. So we focus on educating any party that's involved with alternative investments, whether that's the buyer, the seller, the end investor, the technology behind it. You know, we have a constant flow of educational resources on what best practices should be, what standards should be for these investments, for the buyers, for the providers. And then we do a lot of advocacy. So we advocate to make sure legislators, Congress, DC is aware of what they're doing. I think something like you've mentioned, it's really easy to look at something on paper and disassociate from it. And I think that's something that we see a lot with legislation. It's really easy to lump stuff in as a whole. And so we do a lot of advocacy for financial literacy, for financial access to these types of investments, as well as, you know, regulations and then networking. You know, our primary educational events bring together the buyer, the seller, the third parties so that people can learn more, can get access to different types of investments. And I think one of the things, like I keep saying education, which ties into networking, that we're big on is new products. And we've spent a lot of time, I know you've put in a lot of work just trying to educate on impact investing. And some things are slower and some things are quicker, but it's one of those markets where time and repetitiveness eventually will come through, as well as trends. So that's when I joined Adisa. Well, when I stepped in as CEO, they asked me to step in last year. I kind of had this huge vision, right? Like you start out with this vision when you're interviewing and you're like, we're going to take over the world. This is it. And then you're like, okay, what can we do? And I think when I took over, Adisa was really good at those three things, but it could be better. It could be more forward thinking. We did need to have a focus on these trends that the next generation and the current generation should be looking at or want, which are like impact, I would say diversity, equality, and inclusion, right? Like, what does that look like? What does the room look like that we're in? How are we accessing these things? How are we getting people information? Are we staying up to date with trends? Because if not, this space will get left behind. And I spent my whole career here. I'm extremely passionate about the alternative investment space. And so that was what was exciting to me, was I could help shape this future and the future of investments and help what I consider colleagues that are now friends. I can help my friends. I can help the end investor in what is the next chapter of alternative investments.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to take us up 50,000 feet. We're going to look down at your life, and I don't know exactly where you are in your career, but you know, you've had this financial services career for whatever the math is, 15, 20 years. And look, you have had an unbelievable trajectory. It's frankly, it's been very fast. You sit at this intersection of, I mean, there's only a couple associations that focus on alternative investments like you do. And so if you were to step back and go, hey, my life, if I could script it, or the next, whatever it is, however many more years you have working, let's just say you've got 20 or 30 years, how would you describe yourself in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
Yeah, so 20, nope, definitely. Let's not age me that much. Still a little bit on the younger side. I would say we're kind of just getting started. Like, I feel like we're at this intersection of, there's still so much excitement ahead. There's so much momentum. And even in the past year, I felt it. I felt the energy shift. And I felt like the energy of asset managers and investors shift. Like, it's not to where there's this closed-minded, this is what the investment has to look like. And so that excites me. I think when I look at my career, the excitement of educating on something new or something that has been not as prominent, for example, you know, I'd say impact investing, tax investing, like sports investing, right? Like, I think there's so many cool things that are on the horizon that I want to be a part of it. Like, I want to be a part of making sure it's done correctly so that it doesn't disappear. I think you and I have both seen deals that have been done incorrectly, and I don't want any of these new or important asset classes to be one of them. So I think I look at where do I go in the middle of my career, is I want to set the standards higher. I want the standard for investment products to be higher. I want the access to be not lower, but easier, more accessible, more education. I would love if alternative investments was a household name. Like, if you're saying, where do I want? Like, yeah, I want Adisa and alternative investments to be a conversation that every household's having. And whether that's real estate products to impact a private equity, whatever that may be, I want that conversation to be accessible to all income classes.
So I just heard somebody position alternatives this way. So I'd be curious if you've heard it this way, which I'm sure you have. I just hadn't. They said, let's not talk about alternative. Let's just talk about public markets and private market. Do you agree with that vernacular? Or are you just like, oh, whatever, it doesn't really matter to me?
I could argue both ways. I think that's an easier way to look at it. You know, anything that's not traded, anything that's not on a public market, I think that's getting a little bit muddier with certain, I would say, 40X funds, interval funds, tender offer funds, which are, for definition wise, considered alternative investments, especially as you look at like the retirement plans and where that's going. So I think that line is going to get a little bit blurry.
Yeah, interesting. Because when I heard it, it's like anything, and you just said it, I mean, the lines are going to start to blur. But the point is, and I 100% agree with you, is historically people invest in public securities, public bonds, and this is the opportunity, alternatives, to be mainstream. I'll give you one data point that I use I'll bookend on a while ago, and you will have more knowledge today. And the only reason why I can tell it this, I remember this specific number. So in 2000, I got in the industry in 96, but in 2000, this Adisa alternative space industry, they would have reported $750 million of capital raise in 2000. Fast forward, you tell me, I think I read that in last year, 2025, did we cross 250 billion or 200 billion? So, I mean, some huge number.
Close. I just put together a presentation on it. I know I go off of Stanger's data, but yeah, it was in the 200 billion number, which is wild. I mean, I think if you look at even some small, I would say closed end funds these days raise 500 million a year. So like 750 million seems like so small, but it's wild how rapidly the space has grown and the access to capital has grown in the past 25 years.
So one thing that I've observed, obviously in my career, but then I I do some stuff overseas because of impact investing, where it takes us. So if you have any comments, I'd love for you to just to say something. So as I look at my career, it's 30 years in the industry, and it's basically all, not all, I mean, 28 of it has been in the private or alternative space. Two of it was in public markets. But you go to, if I were to take you to Africa, or I were to take you to, I mean, it doesn't be Africa because everybody is the stereotype, but take you to Africa, take you to South America, take you to Mexico, whatever. This idea of having robust capital markets, like that you sit on, frankly, the top of this at the association, I don't think we stop to think about how important having access to capital for all these users of the capital is. Do you think about that much? Is that something you think that as an industry, do we talk about it enough? Any thoughts on that?
Couple points on this. I do think about it. And I think we in the industry, right? If I'm sitting in a room with the DISA members, I think we're, no pun intended, jaded, right? It's so easy for us to throw around numbers like 500 million or 10 million, or like I raised 20 million last week, you know, like stuff like that. I think people are like, they take it for granted because that's what we're surrounded by. And there's this need for more, always more. Whereas one of my favorite things I love is when you talk to a new asset manager and they want to get in the space and they're like, we just need a couple million dollars to like change our world, right? And you're like, oh, this is going to be fun. Like, you're going to love this. And so I think like we do take it for granted, especially I'm sure similar to you when you go to these other countries, right? Like there is no retail channel, which is kind of the space that we play in. Like there is no retail investor. And I think in general, some people tend to disassociate from the retail investors. I think that is one of the bigger differences in private and public markets. That's also not talked about is where the capital's from and who you're protecting, who you're investing with, and who's propelling you to what your capital can do.
For what it's worth, and I know you and I think similarly of this, however you can, selfishly on my side, I would love for you to continue just to insert that, yes, it's an industry, and yes, it's about making money, and yes, it's about the investors. But man, it is so impactful for these companies or investments that actually need the capital. So I'll give you one example. My younger brother lives in Rwanda, and he was a private equity, private credit guy. He goes back to Yale, gets his MBA, and to the entrance exam to get into Yale, he wrote a little paper or something. And he wrote it about how he wanted to try to get capital flowing to places where capital wasn't getting to, which then by definition means there's probably a lack of capital. There's probably real things that need to get done, and you probably can get rewarded for that. And so connecting what my brother does now, living in Rwanda, talking to you, who is part of this massive industry in the United States today, it's like, it is a powerful thing that you are a part of. So I am cheering for you. I love what you're doing. And I would just say, to the best of your ability, those around you and those, the sponsors, continue just to let them know that, yes, it is about you having a business and all that stuff, but this is a valuable ecosystem that countries, they would kill to have. There's real purpose and meaning behind what Adisa does, and it's real easy to forget that.
Yeah, I think like one of the points, if I could just like remind everyone, especially everyone who's in this space, like capital is power, and it's more than just money. It's more than just investment. It's more than a return. It's a power to shape, or power and opportunity to shape what the future looks like, right? Like that is power you have when you're deciding where those investments go and whether that's another apartment, right? It shapes the culture. You and I, again, we live in Orlando. We know it's shaping the apartment space, but that could be shaping, you know, these other markets, these QOZs, these impact investments. There's so much power behind where you're placing capital and how and who you choose to invest with.
Okay, so you just led me into one of my next questions is, when did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you? And maybe you just describe what it means to you, but articulate a little bit more.
Definitely at Bourne. I would say most of my career evolution was at Bourne. I was there 9 years. And again, one of those things, you know, Bob Bourne, I got really fortunate. I was coming out of a private equity job, and I was like, I just want to work for good people. And so I was like, I'll do whatever. This man seems really nice. Like, I'm going to take a step back. So I took a huge step back in my career just to work there. And it paid off because I was like, hey, what can I try this? Can I do this? And he was like, yeah, let's go. And he was a big proponent. He was like, I want to see, he was a big proponent of me. He doesn't have any daughters. He would say I'm like his second daughter, but also he was a big proponent of seeing women succeed. He's like, people who are smart and who are investor forward. He will run with anything on that. And so I got extremely lucky. But while I was in that role, I got the opportunity to A, shape the investments, but I started out with doing investor relations. And that's something with certain investment backgrounds, or depending on the size of the company, it's usually pretty segregated. But you learn a lot. You learn a lot talking to the people who are writing the check. And I think financial advisors, you guys, they have access to knowing that. I think, again, certain companies, investor meetings, you're hearing these stories like where these people have gotten this money or what they need it for, how bad they need liquidity or what's happening. And you're like, okay. But then also you're trying to explain to them, why do they want, like, why should they give you your money? Right. So why should they trust you? What are you doing? And fortunately, Born did senior housing, which is a very, I say fortunately, I also went through COVID in senior housing. So definitely some unfortunate times, but senior housing is a very emotional business, right? You are caring for someone's loved one. So it's not just to throw money at it and forget it. The operations are very important. They're very touchy-feely and emotional. I'm sure, my significant other would say I'm an emotional person. So this all tracks that I like tie capital into emotions. But I do think when you are looking at the investor and then you're looking at the end investment so closely, for me, like, hey, you're in charge of making sure we raise enough money so that we can get enough people to like fill in the senior housing community so that they can get the correct level of care they need. And then I'm also making sure we don't lose Miss Jones's money. That's powerful. That weighs on you of, okay, it's responsibility and power, like making sure you're protecting both sides. And that's something that I think was a unique opportunity because of the size of the company. But as I started hiring at Born, it was something I required. I required them to take investor calls. I'm like, you need to understand that this isn't just when you go get on this plane to go raise money. Here's whose money you're spending. Here's what's happening. Here's what where it's coming from.
I love your answer, partly because I experienced that. I can resonate so well because I used to work with Bob and for Bob. CNL, when I joined in 96, still was fairly large. I mean, but we had that personal interaction with investors as well back then. And so again, it goes back to even in this example, you're talking about how important the connection is between an asset manager and an investor. And in our world, generally, there's an intermediary in between that called the advisor, which the advisor and the investor have the relationship. But man, that in the end asset manager having some connection, vice versa, is so critical. And I absolutely think you nailed on something really important. Again, I'm going to plug why I love impact investing so much, because if you're an asset manager in the impact investing space, you're investing for return and all that. But you also want to, in your case, let's just say, and I'm sure Bob and you all did this, you want to make sure that your investors understand and feel connected to how their capital is being invested. And so, frankly, I think if you have that connection all the way through, it takes it, and we all say this, but it really takes it from a transaction to a relationship. And I know everybody in the business is going to say we're a relationship, but you and I have been in it long enough, and there's plenty of great people in the industry. But having that connection all the way through, I think, is very, very. So I love that idea of you having, new hires at Born have conversation with investors. Yeah, that's awesome. Let's go to the other side. And to me, it's kind of a coin, and maybe it doesn't have to be the other side of the coin. And I think we're kind of answering some of the questions, but especially as an asset manager, but this is true of all of us, there's this word stewardship. You could probably insert it with other words. How do you think about stewardship, and what does that mean to you? And that, I mean, that could be you answering it as, hey, you're a steward as a CEO of Adisa, or however you want to answer it, but I just would love to hear some thoughts on how you think about stewardship.
Yeah, so I think it depending on, where you are in your career, it can get more complicated or more layered on. But I think in general, one of the things, okay, I think you probably led this charge at CNL. Like stewardship was written on the back of our badge when we scanned into the office every day. And it was instilled in us early on, obviously in my career, that everyone is a steward, everyone is working for the investor. I always think back, I used to ask this question when we were in asset management meetings or when we'd be like working with the lender, anything like that. And it reminds me of the scene from Miracle, the hockey movie. Who do you play for? Who do you play for? Right. And they keep saying their colleges, they keep saying everything. And then finally they're like USA. And I always ask, what is the goal here? Who are we invest? Like, what is the goal? And they're like, to get occupancy up. I'm like, no, what is the goal? And every time it was like, until it's the investor. The investor is our goal, right? Like, first and foremost, we have asked them to trust us with their money. We've asked them to like trust us, follow us on this journey. And so I've always been very much like, as long as we protect the investor, typically everything else happens to take care of itself. I think what I've learned in my career is stewardship grows with accountability, right? Like that, yes, there's the investor. And then I'm like, well, now I have people. I have people I've asked to follow me. So like, how do I protect my people? And now in Adisa, even more, I look at stewardship of what am I setting the standard to? What is the standard? You know, we at Adisa have a unique opportunity. My team, I would say the executive management as well, to shape what the future looks like. And so that's a huge responsibility. And so it is our job to make sure we are saying what is in the best interest of the future, the investors, where the capital is being placed, and how do we help shape that room? And I think more so being a younger woman, it's given me a different platform, given a lot of younger women who are peers, colleagues, to say like, okay, we belong, we have a voice at the table. So I also have, you know, the responsibility of making sure I am creating an image or a pathway to show that this can be done correctly. And, you know, don't take it for granted. Don't mess it up. You have a lot of people looking at you. So leading responsibly and leading in a way that I would be proud of if someone read it back to me. Someone's reading it back to me and saying, this is how you led, or this is how you answered this, or this is how you handled a situation, because you're setting an example. And so I think there's just different levels of stewardship. But for me, it started with the investor, whose money you're taking, and then time. So you have money, time, and then trust. Trust being the founding pillar for all of those.
Thanks for your thoughtfulness on that. And I can see how some in the industry look at a trade association like Adisa, and it's another conference you got to go to. It's another fee you got to pay. But I hope, and yet I know, I mean, I was on the board and I talked to a lot of people, but I hope that people recognize that it is such, organizations like Adisa play such an important role in the industry. To be quite frank, I'm not so sure 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I fully appreciated that either. The older I get, the more I'm like, man, there really is value to that.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, you know, one of the initiatives that's we've been talking about a lot more about lately is, you know, setting the standards for investments. That's something that was always in the background of Adisa, but never a focus on. And I think that is, you know, where our current leadership and our board has been placing a huge focus on is transparency for the investors, transparency in the investments, just to make sure, you know, again, we have this path and we have this opportunity in front of us to create an even bigger ecospace or marketplace than we have. Let's not mess it up. Let's make sure that everyone comes in, kind of does it right, so that these deals can work out, so that we can continue to grow what this marketplace looks like. So we're putting a huge emphasis just on the education and the due diligence surrounding these types of products to raise investment standards.
So if you could have one dream come true for you, and if you need to, that's fine. What would be a dream that you'd say, I would love for this to come true for you?
I have to say, when I think about this, my mom had the best one, and I don't know that it would be mine, but it's one that deserves to be shared. She always said, like, she wanted to win like the Mega Millions, you know, not like 10 million, 750 million. And she wanted to get the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile, and she wanted to like clean it up inside so that it was nice. And she wanted to drive around the country to like smaller suburban towns and just do ridiculously nice things for random people. She's like, I want to walk into the diner and give the single mom a $10,000 tip. Like, and I think that is such a good dream. And I'm like, man, that's such a good answer. I wish that was my answer, because that's always been her dream ever since I was little. Like, even to when she bought a ticket like 3 months ago when everyone was, you know, always she's been like, I just want to have enough money to go do nice things for those who don't expect it.
Think about if we could shake a magic wand and everybody in the United States had that goal. Can you imagine what it'd be like to live in the United States, or pick any country? It changes the way we function.
It is. And like, that just goes to like, I think sometimes people get lost in this like survival mode of like surviving to fight to be the best this versus just this like, what if we could? And there's that balance that I feel like, especially these days, there's such a divisiveness on like success versus kindness. And so kind of rebuild that, I think, is one of those things that would be nice to see more of, and finding that intersection of success with kindness. But I guess since I can't steal my mom's, if I, you know, what would be my dream? I love the platform that we have at Adisa. I think the opportunity to grow that to where Adisa, again, is a household name. I would love for everyone to have access and education to alternatives, regardless of income, regardless of education. I think exposing people to that opportunity, to the opportunity to have a career in this space, is like one of my bigger goals, and eventually to propel that into scholarships. I know that's something Adisa's been trying to figure out, but scholarships to those who are underprivileged to be able to enter this space, to be able to learn to build funds, like to either raise the capital, place the capital, just to understand and have people who make an impact while making a life's income would be one of my bigger goals. I would love to be able to have ADESA shape into something that can help shape the next generation of, not only women, but minorities and lower income and lower education.
When you were saying that, it made me think back of, I started at a company in the public markets called Van Kampen. So it's actually at the epicenter. We were creating and marketing unit investment trusts, which were actually the precursor to ETFs. Okay. And I won't go through that whole story. But so in 97, I came to CNL, so to the alternative investment world. And it was probably, and it wasn't because I had some brilliant idea or, whatever. I wish I had really thought to it. But I think it's probably at about 2005 and on. That industry, the major, the high performers, they then came to the alternative space. And so I have seen, even in my short 30-year career, I've watched how everything was sitting over on public market side and the talent, not that there still isn't talent on the public side, but I've seen this private alternative side grow massively and bringing talent. So when you come in and where you're at, you really have the ability to take it to the next level. And there's no reason why, given some of these potential structural changes and access to 401(k)s and all that kind of stuff, that some of your vision that you're describing, I absolutely think it can be a reality. I mean, it's not gonna be easy, but I think you're in a very interesting spot to try to help be a catalyst for that.
Yeah, I think one of the quotes Bob used to say, I'm sure you've heard it, if it were easy, everyone would be doing it. Yeah.
Need to have another call. We'll just go over Bob-isms.
Yeah,
But it is, and then you talk about people. I got to make one comment because I hope Bob listens to this sometime. But you made a really good comment about finding good people. And one of the things that I see in you that I had the same advantage as you, or the opportunity, is in your case, you had Bob take a chance on you, give you an opportunity. Same thing for me at CNL. I had people who, look, I didn't know what I was doing. And now, clearly there was preparation, all that, but they gave me a shot. And so, I think back to where I'm at and position where you're at is the extent that we can also give people an opportunity is really cool. It's that, I guess, pay it forward. And so you and I have that same, I mean, there's more than just Bob at CNL, but as you're talking and thinking through it, I'm like, yep, you and I have been shaped by some of the same very people, and what a blessing that they've been in our lives. And I gotta believe the reason you and I are talking today is a huge chunk is because of those common relationships and experiences that we've had.
I love the pay it forward. I think that's, again, one of the things I love about this space is you don't have to have a Yale pedigree, right? One of my very good friends worked with you, and he and I both started at the same time, and neither of us had a finance background, right? He switched careers completely. You don't have to, and there's different ways to get into this industry. You don't have to look a certain way or be a certain way. And I think that's something unique that people disassociate from finance. Finance sounds scary, whereas I think the alternative space makes it real. It's more tangible, it's more real life, and that's something I hope I can help show others as they're looking at their career journey.
My last question for you, thank you for taking so much time on this, is do you ever see ADESA, and this not to be official, it just, or do you ever dream about ADESA actually engaging with investors directly?
So this is an interesting journey. I, again, like when I was thinking back to last April when we started talking about me taking over this role, or they approached me and I was, thinking about my interview, I was like, man, ADESA needs to be on like CNBC, right? Investors directly need to hear about what ADESA is. And then you get into it and it's like, what were my goals again? Like you get so bogged down with the everyday, that gets a little bit lost. I think, yes, I think I still am a big advocate of a financial advisor. I think as the individual investor, I look at myself, right? I don't have time to read a PPM and make sure it works for my portfolio. So I still think there's always a place for a financial advisor, but I would love to see financial advisors bringing their investors, educating them alongside, like similar to how now home offices of broker-dealers or RIA due diligence officers, come in and educate themselves. And they're like, financial advisor, you come educate yourself too. So I would love for it to grow to that next level of investor education. I would love to almost have like something separately. I did a poll on my Instagram. I'm a millennial, right? So Instagram, just to see how many of my friends have ever heard of alternative investments. And it was maybe 5%. So I'm like, okay, there has to be some way that we get to the end investor that's not getting to this generation and they're not getting financial
I think I
advisors.
know how.
Podcasts.
No, well, that, and I don't think you have to call it impact investing or whatever, but I think if you bring investment ideas that people care about and want to invest in, forget about whatever you call it, whether it's an alternative, whether it's an impact investment. I see it because that's what I do for a living now. I watch how people, whatever it is, if it's, oh my gosh, I can own some renewable energy that plants out of Africa. I don't care what you call it. It's like, I didn't even know I could do that. Or in your case, you know, based on what you said, did you know you could actually own the underlying real estate of a J. Crew or, you know, whatever? And people are like, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I do think that's the thing that I like. Again, going back to my dad, you can make it sound so simple versus a scary investment. There's a really easy way. And that's the one thing alternatives can do is they take whatever the market is wild. The market is crazy. It's emotionally volatile. Whereas with alternatives, you can actually tell someone a story about what they're investing in and they can understand it and see it. And I do think with impact investing, I think where we're going with today, as I look generationally, a lot of advisors or a lot of people have been hesitant to get on this impact train. I think if you're not offering it, you're going to lose, I would say, my generation. Like, it needs to be a sleeve in a portfolio. It needs to be talked about. It needs to be educated. Otherwise, you're going to seem in this like outdated model and it's going to lead people to like AI or ChatGPT investing, which is not what I want. So I think, you know, the education of whether you're using it or not, you need to know about it and you need to be able to offer it. Otherwise, you're going to lose what that next generation of investors are.
Well, then even go one step further. You just mentioned AI. So let's just say somebody AIs and figures out that I want to invest in XYZ. If you still don't have the human connection and the human stories, you still don't make the full connection. So I actually think this AI world will create new opportunities in hyper-personalization of investments for people. It's just going to make us, I'm a guy whose technology can be used for good or bad, but I think ultimately, like this AI stuff, I think it'll create new ways of advisors working with their investors. And, you know, selfishly, I do think this idea that we've just been talking about, I think is a way to help offset that and frankly, meet them at a deep level. Look, I have a dream of, and I've actually done it, is, you know, not at scale yet. If we're investing in affordable housing, we're investing in Africa just because we do that too, to bring people actually to the site, just like we did in our CNL days, but you do it here locally. But man, to go see this stuff and connect with not only the physical parts of it, but then the humanity and how it's changing them. It's like, wow, that's a special thing. So I would dream that someday we could take a group to some of these. I mean, I guess it's no different really than what we've always done, but like you'd show different things. You think about in the days when, let's say you did class A multifamily, you go see it, it's beautiful, all that kind of stuff. This, if you were to buy affordable housing, you would still go show them, but then you'd want to show how they treat the people differently. And that's where you start to go, oh, this is slightly different. Well, thank you so much for your time. This was fun. Sorry that after whatever, 15 years, we've never sat down and had this much of a conversation, but it's great to get to know you better. And I commend you on your career. Looking forward to seeing what other great things you do. I don't know if there's anything you want to say in closing, or are we good for now?
No, I would say if anyone's interested in learning more, again, investoradvisoradisa.org, ADISA. We have a ton of education. We have podcasts on impact investing. We have podcasts just on alternatives, just education, all of that. I would check out the website just to learn more if you're interested.
Well, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital in your podcast app of choice. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Jade, have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thanks, Jeff.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.